welcome to Irregular Climate, where we take a look at the irregular climate in our atmosphere and the irrational climate of global warming denialism. I am Dan Mutal.
And I'm Graham Wayne.
On this week's show, the Bond Talkfest, Lindsey Graham's flip-flop, respect the EPA's authority, biodiversity at the UN, lawyers don't do science, and the skeptic debunk of the week. First up, the news roundup, starting with the Bond Talkfest.
Last week saw the close of the latest conference held under the auspices of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And this could be described variously as Copenhagen Part 2, the exhumation of a corpse, or indeed just business as usual with a touch of deja vu. It was probably unfortunate that, even as the UN delegates congregated in Bonn, a memo surfaced written by the outgoing climate chief, Ivo de Boer. In it, he was pretty unequivocal in blaming the so-called Danish text, you could describe that as a preemptive stitch-up of the developing countries by the rich countries, for the failure of Copenhagen. It was this text, he thinks, that really sunk the entire affair. According to de Boer, the document was unbalanced and heavily biased in favour of Western nations. The Danish paper destroyed 2 years of effort in one fell swoop, he wrote in this memo. And you can see it online, we'll put a link to it in the show notes. This is de Boer's last conference because he's tendered his resignation after Copenhagen. In Bonn, he was joined by Christiana Figueres, who takes over from de Boer as the UN climate chief next month. From the press reports, she didn't have much to offer except the usual diplomatic platitudes, really. But it's early days, and her reticence might just be a matter of tact more than anything right now. No amount of tact could cover the business-as-usual aspects of this conference. In this case, more attempts by rich countries to do themselves a favour at someone else's expense. It was bad enough that Bolivia had worked out loopholes in pledges actually gave rich countries the option to increase their emissions by 8% compared to 1990 levels, not reduce them at all. And no sooner had this climate accountant's trickery been revealed than it turned out that Russia, Australia and the EU may have been trying to cheat on their greenhouse gas commitments by using forestry accountancy practices that you could say were probably borrowed from Enron. After that, it was hardly revelatory to find out that rich countries are up to various kinds of deceit in order to avoid paying the $30 billion pledged to poor countries that they made last year. It's the usual stuff, double counting, converting existing aid into climate aid, and the EU rather elliptically said the money would be fresh rather than new and additional. Fresh aid. Sounds like a new take on money laundering to me. Now, there was also some dissent at the idea of the World Bank controlling billions of dollars earmarked for climate change, when it was revealed the same bank was also the world's largest investor in fossil fuel industries, in fact to the tune of $4.7 billion last year. Elsewhere, Viscount Monckton and his Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow took to the stage, largely to be roundly ignored. His press conference drew all of 8 journalists, 2 men who admitted they'd gone to the wrong meeting, and a Monckton fan who just cheered every statement uttered by his hero. Unfortunately, a few well-placed questions from journalists who actually knew what they were talking about saw Monckton retreating from the positions he'd established only minutes before. A mix of high intelligence and complete ignorance was how one diplomat described the Viscount's performance. A new draft negotiating text prepared by the UN Secretariat at the close of the official talks proposes that rich countries cut their emissions between 25% to 40% by 2020. Now, this is a target that's utterly unacceptable. It's perceived as just like a red rag to the US, who cannot possibly action it. And as a draft negotiating text, it's about as compromising and as unpopular as the last one. So I'll leave it to the outgoing UN climate chief, Ivo de Boer, to sum up. When asked if he thought the UN could deliver sufficient mitigation targets, de Boer replied, "I am not confident that it will deliver them within the next decade." Well, Nice to know the taxpayers' money is so well spent there, Ivo. Thank you for that.
Last week, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham told reporters that he would vote against the climate bill he helped author. Now he's going one step further. Graham, one of the few Republicans who claim to care about climate change, now says the science about global warming has changed. Now, as someone who follows the science quite closely, I can say with confidence that it has not. And had it changed, I would have been aware of it. In fact, Lindsey Graham seems to agree with this because when pressed on exactly how the science has changed, he could not come up with an answer, instead saying, "The public acceptance about global warming has changed. This is nothing but politics. The fact that the public acceptance of global warming has changed does not mean that the science has changed. The two are separate." This is particularly disappointing because this comes from a senator who just a few months ago slammed a push for what he called a half-assed energy bill and said the idea of not pricing carbon, in my view, means you are not serious about energy independence. The odd thing is you'll never have energy independence until you clean up the air, and you'll never clean up the air until you price carbon. He also said, "Every day we delay trying to find a price for carbon is a day that China uses to dominate the green economy." This is just another example of politics getting in the way of effective policy. In other words, business as usual. This week, the U.S. Senate did not strip away the EPA's power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Powers that the Supreme Court ruled the EPA must use. The Murkowski resolution, which would have stripped away these powers, was defeated by a vote of 47 to 53. At the end of the day, I am quite sure that it would be better to get Congress to legislate controls on greenhouse gas emissions, preferably with market-based policies, rather than let the EPA regulate them. But EPA regulation is better than nothing, which, after Lindsey Graham's flip-flop, seems more likely than not. That's it for the news roundup. Up next, errata. The good news is we don't have any errata from last week's show. The bad news is last week we forgot to do the errata for the previous show. So let's get on with it. In episode 2, I mentioned that the book, The Lomborg Deception, was written by Thomas Lovejoy. It was not. It was written by Howard Friel. Lovejoy wrote the foreword of the book. In fact, in a recent interview, Friel had this to say. "So Lomborg was very clever to present himself as a centrist. But when you get into the details of his book, he's hardly a centrist. I think he would be fairly classified as a climate denier. He takes almost every climate-related issue, from polar bears to melting glaciers to rising sea levels, and in my view, very problematically downplays the significance of the impact of global warming on these areas." It's also worth checking out the website, lomborgerrors.dk, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Also, an investigation by the Danish Committee on Scientific Dishonesty concluded, "Objectively speaking, the publication of the work under consideration, The Skeptical Environmentalist, written by Lomborg, is deemed to fall within the concept of scientific dishonesty. In the view of the subjective requirements made in terms of intent or gross negligence, however, Bjorn Lomborg's publication cannot fall within the bounds of this characterization. Conversely, the publication is deemed clearly contrary to the standards of good scientific practice." In other words, Lomborg's book is dishonest, however, it cannot be shown that it was intentionally dishonest. And though this investigation has been criticized, the main criticism was that a list of errors was not provided. The book Lomborg Deception and the website lomborgerrors.dk have since provided us with a very long list of errors. Also this week, representatives from close to 90 countries gathering in Busan, Korea, approved the formation of a new organization to monitor the ecological state of the planet and its natural resources. Dubbed the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, this new entity will likely meet for the first time in 2011 and operate much like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Aiming to be policy relevant, not prescriptive, it will issue peer-reviewed reports summarizing the state of biodiversity research every few years. The plan will come before the General Assembly of the United Nations, slated to meet in September for official approval, but those involved in the process say this is merely a formality. Biodiversity loss is a major problem, one made worse by climate change. However, making quantitative predictions, which is exactly what policymakers want and need, is much more difficult than doing so with climate, which is quite difficult in and of itself. But we are quite certain that biodiversity is being lost at an alarming rate, so much so that the current period has been called the sixth mass extinction event, which compares it to previous extinction events such as the one that caused the dinosaurs to become extinct. Already deniers are jumping on this and denying that biodiversity loss is a problem.
Okay, next up, Dan's going to tell us a bit about a very strange situation going in at Penn State, where the legal profession seems to have fancied getting involved in climate change. Well, how does this come about, Dan?
Well, essentially, Jason Scott Johnson from the Faculty of Law, I don't know if it's the whole Faculty of Law, or it's just this one kook, I guess, in there, he decided to do a cross-examination of anthropogenic global warming, which... You know, my initial reaction is essentially the same as if a lawyer had claimed to do a cross-examination or to disprove, you know, evolution or plate tectonics or any other well-established science.
Okay, you call it a cross-examination. So who is it acting for the defense?
No one, actually, which is why it's, even though he calls it a cross-examination, it really isn't. If you're going to stick with sort of the legal analogy, it's more of a prosecutor statement where he lays out his case. There's no rebuttal. There's no attempt to look at any of the arguments. In fact, he seems to just take denier talking points at face value, with does no further investigation, just assumes they're true. And you kind of, you know, the giveaway is that towards the end, when he's thanking people who helped him put this document together, he lists sort of all the people who helped him proofread and find errors. And, it's a short list, but it's a list of basically of deniers. They're all people who are way out of the mainstream climate science. So
what kind of people are we talking about?
You're looking at Ross Mikritic, who is a critic of the hockey stick. He's an economist. You know, he's based in Canada. Richard Lindzen, who is a real climate scientist. He has proposed low climate sensitivity, but interesting idea, but the data never really was there to confirm it. Roger Pilkey Sr., who's made some very – he is a climate scientist, but he's made some dodgy claims of late that have been thoroughly taken apart and shown to be false. But he really completely ignored mainstream climate science, which is exactly what you don't want to do. If you're a non-expert going into a field – I feel that's not your expertise and really want to look at it, you really need to get an understanding of what the mainstream in that field says.
Okay. If they're the only people who've helped him, I mean, there's going to be some significant bias in the kind of information he's dealing with, surely.
Absolutely. I mean, you can definitely see that in the main points he tries to make, his sort of the areas where there's significant uncertainty in climate science.
Right. Okay. Well, should we look at some of the claims he's made?
Yeah, why don't we go on to that? Do you want to read the first one?
Yeah, sure. Okay, this is the text I'm going to read is exactly how this prosecution has been mounted. Okay, the first point he makes here is there seem to be significant problems with the measurement of global surface temperatures over both the relatively short run, late 20th century, and longer run, past millennium. problems that systematically tend to cause an overestimation of late 20th century temperature increases relative to the past. Yeah, now, that doesn't sound right to me.
It doesn't sound right to me either. So as we discussed last week, the instrumental record, which is essentially the data that deals with 20th century temperatures, there's several different data sets, and they're all in general agreement. Last week we talked about denier / skeptic Roy Spencer, who works at the University of Alabama Huntsville satellite-based data set. He helps put that together, and he says that his data set matches up with Phil Jones' data set, and so unless they're all making the same mistake, which is unlikely, they're fairly reliable.
Sure.
The legal opinion kind of also goes into the whole hockey stick controversy, but there's something like 13 other independent studies that all pretty much agree with what the hockey stick said. And the U.S. National Academy of Sciences was asked to look at this issue by the U.S. Congress, and this is basically what they concluded. They said, the basic conclusion of Mann et al., 1998 and 1999, which were the original hockey stick papers, was that the late 20th century warmth in the Northern Hemisphere was unprecedented during the last 1,000 years. This conclusion has subsequently been supported by an array of evidence that includes both additional large-scale surface temperature reconstructions and pronounced changes in a variety of local proxy indicators, such as melting on ice caps and the retreat of glaciers around the world, which in many cases appear to be unprecedented during the last 2,000 years.
Unprecedented.
Unprecedented, yes. That's what the National Academy of Sciences said. Mm-hmm. But even if they were wrong, even if the hockey stick was wrong, that still doesn't really speak to the case for global warming, which really deals with the properties of CO2 and how that acts as a forcing on climate. We all know there are other forcings, and we touched on this last year, but there are other forcings that can affect climate. CO2, obviously, anthropogenic CO2 wasn't an issue during the medieval warm period. If something else did warm the climate back then, and we don't really have much evidence for that being a global phenomenon, that doesn't mean that CO2 isn't warming the climate now.
There's something else as well I constantly puzzle about this. I mean, to say there's been an overestimation of late 20th century temperatures, well, if you look at the cryosphere, any part of it, you're seeing ice melting and the acceleration is increasing in speed. I'm not quite sure how this argument can be made credibly.
I'm not sure. There was a great article in Nature, and I'll have to try to find the link for that because it's been a while since I last looked at it. But they looked at a huge array of sort of biological indicators. Mm-hmm. If the thermometers are wrong, if the satellite data is wrong, you know, we can kind of throw all that away and look at sort of what the expected response of the biosphere is to warming. And we see the changes in these indicators all consistent with the warming we've been measuring.
Sure.
So really, I mean, unless the flowers, the birds, the animals, the trees, all of those things are in on the giant conspiracy, we're warming. I mean, and if they aren't on the giant conspiracy, that's pretty impressive. So on its own.
I must say, yeah. Okay. All right. Let's look at the next point that he brings up here then.
All right.
He says, continuing scientific dispute exists over whether observations are confirming or disconfirming, is that a word? Disconfirming? Key short-run predictions of climate models, such as an increase in tropospheric water vapor or an increase in tropical tropospheric surface temperatures relative to tropical surface temperatures.
Yeah, well, the key word in this is short-term. Because, I mean, he doesn't really define what short-term is very well. But models, the current crop of models doesn't say much about what's going on in the short term. They're really looking at more of a long-term approach. So, what happens in the next 10 years is all very interesting and a lot of people want to know. But the models aren't good enough yet to give us a good answer of what's happening in the short term. Over the long term, kind of that weather averages out. And a trend emerges, and that is what the climate models are better able to show. though they don't really are very good at doing weather. There has been, however, some work done on improving that, because it's obviously very useful for policy decisions and stuff. And the deniers should be well aware of this work because they did champion these new preliminary models, so they're not even very good yet, and I wouldn't put a lot of confidence in them yet. They did champion them because some of them do show a flattening of temperatures over the next little while. Mm-hmm. Of course, what the deniers didn't mention is that after that you know, short little flattening, the temperatures skyrocket up. And I think if I remember the date correctly, it was 2050. By the time we get to 2050, we're essentially at the same spot as the more traditional models show, but we've been warming over the past few decades at a much higher rate of warming. So, but actually, they actually paint a worse picture. So, I mean, really, I mean, the keyword is short term, and the models don't say much on the short term, and disproving the models on the short term is really not possible because they're not saying anything on the short term, not with any confidence at least.
All right, the next point he makes is, he says, climate model projections of increases in global average surface temperature due to a doubling of atmospheric CO2 above about 1 degree centigrade arise only because of positive feedback effects presumed by climate models. Yet there is evidence that both particular feedback, such as that from clouds, and feedbacks in total may be negative, not positive.
Okay, so this, I imagine he got this from Lindzen. He came up with the iris hypothesis, which, as I said, was interesting and definitely something worth looking at. But the data hasn't been there to confirm it. In fact, some data now shows that the iris effect might actually be positive, although again this is not conclusive. So it does represent an unknown in climate models. But if we had significant negative feedback, so kind of the warmer we got, the climate system pushes back, that would indicate a self-stabilizing climate. And just looking at, you know, the paleoclimate record, we know that's not likely true. I mean, the planet goes from ice ages to interglacial periods with very little ice, back to ice ages. So clearly that says the climate is not, self-stabilizing.
Okay. When you, this term self-stabilizing, do you mean the climate, you're suggesting, or he's suggesting actually, that the climate has a tendency towards stability rather than instability?
Exactly. Yeah. So if something acts as a forcing on the climate, like our CO2 emissions, like anything else, the sun or anything, what that would mean is that the effect on the climate would be very small, because feedback, negative feedback, so things that kind of counteract this forcing, would kick in and keep the climate relatively stable. This is also, sometimes you hear this said as low climate sensitivity. But really, as I said, the paleoclimate record does not support this. In fact, Wallace Broker, way back in 1995, wrote, the paleoclimate record shouts out to us that far from being self-stabilizing, the Earth's climate system is an ornery beast which overreacts to even small nudges. So that, I mean, that sums it up right there. And that, you know, that's why we have ice ages, and that's why we have interglacial periods where there is no ice or very little ice.
It's a shame Jason Scott Johnson didn't think to actually invite some people along to talk to him, to give him a rather more informed point of view.
Yeah.
Look at this next point. Confidence in climate models based on their ability to causally relate 20th century temperature trends to trends in CO2 may well be misplaced, because such models do not agree on the sensitivity of global climate to increases in CO2 and are able to explain 20th century trends only by making arbitrary and widely varying assumptions about the net cooling impact of atmospheric aerosols.
Right. So this brings me to another quote, and I forget who said it, but it says, it was a modeler, and I'm not sure if he was a climate modeler. Models are used in all fields of science, or many fields of science, but he said, all models are wrong, some models are useful. Yeah. And it's, I mean, climate models are a simplification of reality. We don't yet have the ability to perfectly model the climate system. We probably never will, or at least not anytime soon. So obviously there are some assumptions being made and some things will turn out to be wrong. That doesn't mean they're not useful, but really the confidence in the climate models doesn't come from their ability to correlate CO2 and temperature. It comes from their ability to recreate the whole climate system. As I mentioned before, we have confidence that they can do this because we hindcast. We start the model sometime in the past and we run the model forward and see if the model output matches the model what we observed. And because, I mean, they generally do that, some model, obviously there's models out there of varying quality, but they do that fairly well. So we have confidence that they can do that going forward as well.
Okay. But then he goes on to say similar reasons for questioning climate models is provided by the continuing, he alleges, the continuing scientific dispute over whether late 20th century warming may have been simply a natural climate cycle or be caused by solar variation versus being caused by anthropogenic increases in atmospheric CO2.
All right. The first thing that jumps out to me in that statement is the term natural cycle.
Mm-hmm.
That's really a cop-out. Be specific. What natural cycle? Volcanoes? He does mention the sun, but there's cosmic rays. There's different cloud formations, changes in ocean circulation. There's tons of natural cycles. Saying natural cycles is kind of saying, well, I don't really know what, but I know it's not anthropogenic in cause. It must be nature. You really need to be specific. But anyway, more importantly, those disputes do not exist in the scientific literature.
Right.
There's no evidence for solar variation. Natural cycles cannot explain the temperature trend. The climate scientists have known for a long time that many things can affect climate. Greenhouse gas emissions are one of the things that can affect climate, but they look at a whole array of different factors. They call them forcings that can affect climate. None of the other forcings can explain the current temperature trends. Only CO2 can. And not just the trends, the whole profile of the climate system. Mm-hmm. So that includes something like stratospheric cooling, which is really only happens if greenhouse gas emissions are responsible for global warming. On this point, really, the scientific literature is virtually unanimous. And this is why he really should have consulted with climatologists who are in the mainstream of climate scientists, whose views are the norm.
Do you get the suspicion that the points that he's making are reiterations of the opinions of the people that did advise him?
In a lot of ways I do. I mean, this is a lot of these do come up from, you know, they're really standard denial talking points that have been debunked before. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, had he done a little bit of research instead of taking these points at their word and at face value, he would have seen that, you know, I mean, had he just gone to John Cook's Skeptical Science site,
yeah,
he could have disproved most of these. I mean, really, I mean, I didn't have to do a whole lot of digging to find out why these were wrong because I've heard all of these before. They're not new. And the fact that he presents them as new is really disingenuous if he's trying to present a legal or a proper, informed analysis of global warming.
Well, I'm not sure how he can possibly present a balanced picture if the issues are not represented, at least, you know, that the other side of the argument is not represented. If there's no one batting on that side, well, then there is no opposition. This is a monologue, not a dialogue.
Right, which is why I said it really is not a cross-examination, but more of a prosecutor statement. Mm-hmm. And I guess prosecutors do, you know, I'm not a legal expert, but it seems to me that lawyers tend to focus on proving their case more than they focus on getting to the truth. And I may be stepping in a lot of hot water and and annoying a lot of of lawyers, but to me, lawyers are not as trustworthy as scientists. So I actually know climate scientists. I know a lot of people that are heavily involved in looking and understanding the climate system. And I have no doubt that if they found something that cast doubt on global warming and disproved it, they would write about it. They're interested in the truth. They're not interested in a position.
Sure.
Interested in the truth. Not only that, if they were able to disprove climate change, they'd be famous.
Yep. That's the big prize right now would be for the scientist who could come up with some other explanation, and we'd all be able to step back relieved and say, God, it isn't us.
Yeah, it'd be great, actually.
Yeah, sure would. And deeply unlikely.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So moving on then, let's have another look at some of these points he's making then. He now says this, the scientific ability to predict what are perhaps the most widely publicized adverse impacts of global warming, sea level rise and species loss, he singles out, is much less than generally perceived. And in the case of species loss, predictions are based on a methodology that a large number of biologists have severely criticized as invalid, and as almost certain to lead to an overestimate of species loss due to global warming.
Right. So this, I mean, again, the key word in this one is perceived, or generally perceived. I mean, one can find examples in the media of presenting, massive sea level rise. They don't touch it nearly as much on biodiversity loss. But, I mean, you know, we've all seen Inconvenient Truth where it shows what would happen if Greenland or Antarctica melt, and it shows the massive sea level rise and that how absolutely devastating that would be. And it would be devastating. And even though, but it's not explicitly stated that this isn't likely to happen soon. I mean, there's a ton of ice, and melting all that ice would take an enormous amount of heat energy. So it's not, I mean, even though there are worrying things happening on Greenland and Antarctica, we don't expect them to melt anytime soon, at least not fully melt anytime soon. We do expect the sea level to rise more than predicted in the IPCC because of that, but we don't expect it to rise like it's been shown, like it was shown in Inconvenient Truth, at least not anytime soon.
Sure. But the fact is there's so much water in the Antarctic and the Greenland ice caps that only a small amount of melting will give us a significant amount of sea level rise.
Significant, yes, and quite bad, but not sort of how it's been shown in some areas of the media. There have been more responsible places that haven't really shown sort of the absolute devastation, where most of Florida goes underwater or anything. That's not likely to happen soon, although Florida and other coastal areas will be affected by much less sea level rise. Mm-hmm. This brings me to a quote that I stole from Scott Adams. He's the creator of Dilbert, which I modified. The original was about evolution, but it really highlights the issue here, and it goes like this. It says, the evidence for global warming that is available to the casual person of interest, including most students, is simplified to the point of being misleading, false, or useless. In other words, the popular argument for global warming is bullshit. Independent of the underlying reality of global warming or the evidence available to the experts in the field. So just because lay people misunderstand an issue, that doesn't mean the science is uncertain.
It means lay people are uncertain.
Right, which, I mean, makes sense, especially on complex issues.
Sure.
And getting back to the claims of sea level rise being too high, I'd like to know how he accounts for the fact that the IPCC ignored a major contributor to sea level rise, which is the melting ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica.
Now, this was left out because they weren't able to come up with a methodology that they themselves thought was convincing.
Right, exactly. They also did a few other things, like they only projected sea level rise to 2095. They used less warming than the model showed to predict sea level rise. They did a lot of things that may have underestimated sea level rise, which isn't surprising because if you understand how the IPCC review process works, you know that it is designed to produce a conservative document.
Sure.
A document that is not way out there. It's not on the bleeding edge. It's not making claims that a lot of disagreement with what it's saying is anything it says there's substantial agreement on within the scientific community, which means it's going to be conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And we know this. I mean, well, we don't know. There's good evidence of this, knowing that since the IPCC was released in 2007, several studies have been conducted on sea level rise, and we see that that they all pretty much say predict more substantially more sea level rise than the IPCC did.
So there's a trend here, though, isn't there? I mean, in actual fact, scientists generally are conservative. They always hedge their bets. They're never going to sound certain in a situation where, in their minds, the results they have are subject to even the slightest amount of equivocation. So it seemed to have been a consistent theme since AR4 that a lot of the science is trying to be moderate, trying not to sensationalize the issue. As you said earlier, what happens is the media get hold of it. They just want the headline, and so they're going to kind of make everything sound as dramatic as possible. But, you know, as you pointed out, leaving out glacier melt, leaving out the uncertainties of sea level rise, now we know how fast the ice is melting. It means that the IPCC projections are the low end of what we can expect rather than the high end.
Exactly, yeah. And that's, I mean, again, if you know if you have an idea of how the IPCC review process works, this isn't surprising. This is how it was designed. It was designed to be conservative. But getting on to his other claim of biodiversity, biodiversity claims are more uncertain. That's the nature of biology. Biology tends to be more complicated than physics. There's not, you know, those simple laws that you have in physics, are much more complicated. One of my ecology profs in university used to say about ecology, says, you know, this isn't rocket science. It's more complicated. I mean, they really are phenomenally complex systems. So understanding or estimating biodiversity loss is more complicated. But there is a lot of disagreement, but no one really paints a pretty picture. Biodiversity is already a major issue. The period we're in right now has been called the sixth mass extinction event. So that kind of compares back to the time where the dinosaurs went extinct. And from a geological perspective, you know, all of human civilization really is a single event, you know, a fraction of time, a point on the timeline.
Yeah, sure.
Even though from our perspective, it looks like forever. And climate change will only make it worse. I mean, no one expects climate change to improve the biodiversity situation, especially in the oceans, where ocean acidification will change ocean chemistry dramatically, and a lot of species will not be able to adapt.
It's interesting, isn't it? You know, you bring in one issue there, the changing pH of the ocean. Surely, what's really quite scary about all this is that a lot of things are all changing very quickly, and the difficulty of predicting what the results is going to be is because there are so many variables here. But as you say, when you put a system under stress like this and there isn't enough time for it to adapt, then you can reasonably expect that the results are going to be unpleasant, to say the least.
Right. Yeah. That's just how it works. I mean, a lot of species can't adjust. And it's really made worse by habitat fragmentation. So climate change in the past, if it happens slowly enough, and it's happening quite fast, kind of ecosystems and species within those ecosystems can migrate north or migrate up mountains to, you know, where the climate, you know, as the climate moves in those directions.
Mm-hmm.
But now the habitats for most animals are so heavily fragmented that there are barriers that prevent these migrations from taking place. So it used to be, you know, a massive contiguous forest, for example, now is full of roads and cities and other, other things that present a lot of times impassable barriers to a lot of wildlife. I mean, even something like a road, which doesn't seem like much, can be an impassable barrier. I know in the Canadian Rockies, people looking at grizzly bear populations were worried that bears were not really crossing the highway, and they spent millions of dollars on these giant overpasses with trees and vegetation over them that the highway goes right under. And the bears still don't use that. And I mean, these are big animals that could very easily cross the road, but looking at them, they find they don't. So, I mean, even a big animal on what to us seems like a very relatively small, impact on the landscape, just, you know, a highway, really impacts the ability for species to adapt to climate change.
Yeah, too many unknowns, really.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, okay, coming back to this this Jason Scott Johnson piece then, this last point, he seems to touch on, in fact, he's trying to make some leverage, it seems to me, out of the disputes that you mentioned, because there are so many variables. He says, finally, many of the ongoing disputes in climate science boil down to disputes over the relative validity and reliability of different observational data sets, suggesting that the very new field of climate science does not yet have standardized observational data sets that would allow for definitive testing of theories and models against our observations. Now, that just sounds like a kind of a cunning way of saying this isn't real science.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what he's getting, but this is kind of the norm for most observational science. The situation is not perfect, and these disputes are a means to improve the situation. But a lack of perfection does not indicate that the current status quo can't provide us with conclusions with high degrees of certainty. I mean, just because everything isn't perfect, and there are disputes among scientists, you shouldn't extrapolate that to suggest that scientists don't know what they're doing, especially when the scientists involved in these disputes themselves say, no, we know that the Earth is warming due to greenhouse gas emissions with a high degree of certainty.
Well, so to sum up, really, this legal approach that he's taken up here, but ends up just being a rehash of the kind of arguments that we keep seeing.
Exactly. And I really have to wonder, to anyone championing this document, where is your skepticism? If you claim to be a skeptic, you should be very skeptical when a non-expert claims expertise and tries to, you know, or goes against the mainstream views in another field. So, I mean, if you accept this document, if you accept a lawyer telling, overturning science, would you get your legal advice from a scientist? I mean, most people wouldn't even cross their mind. But if you're not willing to get your legal advice from a scientist, why are you willing to get your science advice from a lawyer?
Okay, the most significant thing that you said to me in this entire little sort of piece here is that he could have gone to skeptical science, just read what John Cook's written and just gone through the science himself and discovered there was more to his arguments than he had presented.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, there's nothing new here. What is new is that a lawyer is doing it, a lawyer at a respective school. I mean, Penn State is quite well known. I don't know about their how good their legal department is. Certainly they've got a lot of good climate scientists working at Penn State. But I don't see how anyone should champion this. Really, the fact that they are indicates that they are deniers willing to grasp at anything. This seems to bolster their case, and they're not looking at this issue honestly, because if they were, they would have realized that these points have been proposed already, dealt with already, and so they shouldn't be brought up again. It's time to move on to something else.
And indeed, we are moving on, because now it's time for John Cook's Skeptic Debunk of the Week.
How sensitive is our climate? In other words, how much will the global temperatures rise if we double the amount of CO2 in the air? If there were no climate feedbacks, the planet would warm around 1 degree Celsius from doubled CO2, but there are many feedbacks. Water vapor provides a positive feedback that amplifies the warming. On the other hand, a warmer world radiates more heat back into space. This is a negative feedback. What is the overall climate feedback? Is it positive or negative? Richard Lindzen and Yong Sang Choi try to answer this question by comparing sea surface temperatures to outgoing radiation as measured by satellites. What they found was as it got hotter, more radiation escaped out to space. By comparing periods of strong warming to outgoing radiation, they concluded that the overall climate feedback was negative. This result has been cited by skeptics who say we don't have to worry about global warming. Negative feedbacks will minimize the damage. However, a number of peer-reviewed papers have had a close look at Lindzen's analysis and found several fundamental flaws. One problem is their result depends heavily on the start and end points of their warming periods. Small changes in the choice of dates gives you a completely different result. Basically, you can tweak the start and end points to obtain any feedback you like. Another serious problem is they only use tropical data. The tropics are not a closed system. A great deal of energy is exchanged between the tropics and subtropics. To work out a global response, you need global observations. A number of papers do exactly this. They compare satellite measurements of outgoing radiation to surface temperatures, just like Lindzen did. The difference is they use global data, and all of these studies find the same thing, net positive feedback. Unfortunately, negative feedback is not the get-out-of-jail card skeptics were hoping for.
That's it for this week's show. Show notes will be posted at irregularclimate.com. Also at the website, we have plenty of RSS feeds for following us and subscribing to the podcast. We are also available in the iTunes Music Store. And if you're in the Music Store, please rate us or add a review. We also have links to our Twitter and Facebook pages. Follow us and send us feedback. Tell us what we are doing well and what we need to improve on. Also, if you feel so inclined and want to support the podcast, you can donate to Irregular Climate via PayPal. The links are on the website. But if you are unable or unwilling to donate, please continue to download and listen. That in and of itself supports the show and helps it grow. I am Dan Mutal. You can follow me at ofdan.ca, where you can see links to my blog, my Twitter feed, my Flickr feed, and everything else I do online. Thanks, and until next week, try and stay regular.